Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Phil Dierking, and Anna Mateo. Later, Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver have a special report on one of America's national treasures. But first, this report. What do all of the over 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States have in common? The answer is not a lot. These schools are all different in many ways. The same is true for their requirements for admitting students. College applications can often be very complex, with several parts. And as the number of people seeking a college education increases every year, competition for admission also grows. So students often end up applying to more than one school, which can be a lot of work. That is why a growing number of colleges and universities have started using the Common Application Method, also known as the Common App. It began with 15 U.S. universities in 1975. Today, over 730 schools worldwide have students apply for admission this way. Any student can use the Common App so long as he or she is connected to the Internet. The system lets students use one set of materials to apply to as many of its member schools as they want, all at once. To get started, simply go to the Common Application website.
Sarah Brookshire is the Director of Admissions at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Brandeis, a private research university, does have a traditional application process, where students can apply directly to the school. But Brookshire says less than 2% of its applicants do so. Most apply through the Common App website. Brookshire says the purpose of using this method is to reduce barriers for students and make the application process less stressful. Some colleges may feel students are showing less interest in finding the best school for them by using the Common App. Some may feel that students simply want to increase their chance of getting accepted. Brookshire admits that students could seek admission to 730 schools if they really wanted to. But many schools that use the Common App require students to pay individual application fees. So the process could get very costly. Brookshire adds that students can no longer expect to get into the first or second school they choose. So the hope was to be honest about the process, but also to still ask students to be thoughtful, Brookshire told VOA. Find those 8 to 10 schools that are appropriate and exciting for you, and go ahead and just send materials to them.
Like traditional college applications, the Common App website has several parts. The first is where applicants provide personal information, such as their sex, ethnicity, and citizenship. Students may also be asked what languages they speak and details of their family. Brookshire says this kind of information gives the school an idea of who the applicant is. The second part of the application is where students provide information about their education history. This includes what high school they attended and their academic performance during the high school years. It also includes a list of the classes students are currently taking and any college-level classes they may have taken. Brookshire notes that attention to detail is very important. Most colleges and universities ask for official documents from a student's high school to confirm what they are reporting is true. So, dishonesty would be a mistake. Also, students should be careful about spelling mistakes as well as names or words used in email addresses.
The third part is where students list any awards or honors they have received. It is also where students list their activities outside of the classroom. Brookshire thinks this part is one of the most important. What we're doing on the college side is trying to understand a student's possible fit for our community, she said. It has to do with which student groups and organizations that we think they might be involved with, what kind of effect they're going to have on campus, whether or not we think they'll succeed in a very busy environment. Brookshire suggests that students think hard and list as much as they can in the activity section. Sports teams, volunteer organizations, and part-time jobs are all good examples. But, she argues, applicants should also consider adding less structured activities. Most colleges want to see that students have a lot of different interests. However, an applicant demonstrating hard work and responsibility can also be appealing to admissions officials. For example, Brookshire says, a student could talk about how they had to come home after school every day to care for an aging family member. That would explain why they did not have time to join a school band or debate team.
The fourth part of the common application is the personal essay. This section shows a student's ability to communicate in writing, as well as demonstrate their critical thinking skills. Students must choose one of several open-ended questions about themselves. Then, they must answer the question in about 400 to 600 words. Brookshire says this is a chance for students to explain themselves in a way that the other parts of the common application do not. It lets them be creative, while also showing the way they think and see the world based on their own experiences. She adds that when choosing which question to answer, students should think about how the subject relates to the schools they would like to attend. One of the past questions was similar to this. Think about a time when you questioned a belief or idea. What affected your thinking and what was the result? Brookshire says this might be a good question for a student hoping to attend a liberal arts college. Classes at this kind of school will often ask students to question their understanding of the world. But common application member schools often request changes to the application materials, and the essay questions do change from year to year. The newest form is released once a year on or close to July 1st. And as Brookshire notes, the more time students spend on the essay, the better.
Finally, the last part of the application is a teacher recommendation. This is where a teacher with a personal connection to the applicant writes a letter in support of the student. This letter describes the personal qualities of the student and why the college or university should accept them. Students have no control over what the teacher might write. So Brookshire says a student should probably choose a teacher who taught a subject related to the field they want to study in college. Or students could ask a teacher whose class they struggled but succeeded in the end. Brookshire suggests that a thoughtful letter from a teacher like that could show that the student never gives up, even when things get difficult. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto. Two pilots recently set a new altitude world record for gliders. A glider is an aircraft that does not have an engine. They are pulled into the air by powered airplanes and then released. They are designed to ride warm, rising air to gain altitude. The Perlin II glider reached an altitude of 15,902 meters on September 3rd. The two pilots flew their aircraft above mountains in southern Argentina. The pilots beat the earlier world record for gliders by 441 meters. The pilots hope the ability of their plane to reach the edge of outer space will influence young people to follow careers in science and engineering. The glider was pulled into the air by a small plane. At about 3,000 meters, the plane released the connecting cable and started looking for strong updrafts of air, called the mountain waves, to take them higher. According to Chief Pilot Jim Payne, it took 11 flights to reach the altitude record.
And basically, we take steps of a certain amount of altitude and airspeed, gather data, analyze that data, and if those data conform to our theory and the model that we have for the airplane, then we can safely go on to the next step.
A glider flight at high altitude is very difficult. The glider has no engine to fight turbulence they may encounter. Also, although the airspeed instrument shows the speed of only 80 to 90 kilometers per hour, the true airspeed can be much higher. At those high speeds, the wings may flutter to the point of breaking. Also, it is very cold, said pilot and project manager Morgan Sandercock.
We have electric socks on the pilots. We literally could not fly without those electric socks. We would get frostbite. And heated vests, and we're looking at upgrading our heating systems for next year, because cold is the big issue that we've been dealing with this year.
The Perlin II glider is made of a special kind of light carbon fiber material. It also has improved mechanical properties. The company Airbus helped build the glider and transport it to Argentina. Ken McKenzie, an employee with Airbus, says the company hopes the project will attract young people to science and technology.
We want to actually grab the next group of pilots, engineers, mechanics, airport operators, flight attendants, basically kids that are in high school and university right now that may not have considered aerospace as a career, and we want to inspire them.
In the future, the pilots hope to break the world altitude record for level flight of 25,929 meters, set in 1979
by the U.S. spy plane called the SR-71 Blackbird. The pilots also plan to turn their aircraft into a non-polluting research vehicle for the stratosphere. I'm Phil Dierking.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this show, we explore the origins and usage of common expressions in American English. During September in the United States, and in many places around the world, children are going back to school. Even if your school days have long passed, you may remember this time of the year well. The smell of books and pencils, the sound of your footsteps as you enter a strange classroom, the nervous feeling in your stomach as you meet your new teacher. Naturally, we all want to do well in school and life. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. So today, we are going to talk about both. The expressions you will hear in today's program are commonly used in a classroom, but they can also be used in other situations. Let's start with the bad situations first. Now, as you probably know, a bomb is something that blows things up. In American slang, when something bombs, it fails completely. So if you fail a test, you bombed it. We also often use bomb this way when talking about movies, plays, or performing. For example, if a comedian is on stage telling jokes, but no one is laughing, you can say his jokes are bombing. Afterward, if you are feeling very mean, you could say to him, "Wow, you really bombed." Now, let's say nobody goes to the new superhero movie. You can say it bombed at the box office. The box office is where people buy their movie tickets. In this case, they were buying tickets for a dud or a flop. These two words are often used to describe a form of entertainment that failed in its purpose, to entertain. Even a party that bombs can be called a dud or a flop. And if a class you are taking is boring or useless, you could call it a real dud. Now let's go back to bombing. Please take note that when the word bomb is a verb, it means to fail. As a slang expression, however, the bomb often describes something really good. For example, if a high school student wears a new pair of sneakers to school, his friends could say, "Those shoes are the bomb." That means they are great in a cool, awesome kind of way. But please be careful. Using the bomb this way is extremely casual and would not be appropriate to use in a formal situation. For example, let's say your boss wears a new suit to an important meeting. It might not be a good career move to say to her, "That outfit is the bomb. You look awesome." And making comments about a bomb at a U.S. airport could get you arrested. So, as we said, be careful. Now, let's talk about expressions to use when you do something really well. Let's say you did well on a test. You got 100% correct. You aced it. You can also say that you passed with flying colors. The last expression might make you think of a big celebration, like maybe your parents celebrated your passing grade by lighting colorful fireworks. But you would be wrong. Word experts seem to agree that the expression to pass with flying colors comes from the military. In this case, pass doesn't mean to succeed, but to travel. And colors doesn't mean shades like red or blue, but flags. According to the website, the Phrase Finder, pass with flying colors originally describes winning ships sailing into port, with flags flying from all the mastheads. By around 1700, the phrase was being used to describe any kind of victory. That means you can use pass with flying colors when you are being graded on a test or course, but also in a situation that is out of your control, such as a medical exam. Let's say you are nervously waiting in a doctor's exam room for the results of a blood test. The doctor may come in and say, "Don't worry, I'm looking at the results of your blood test, and you passed with flying colors." It's not as if you studied for your blood test and then did well on it. So this is the doctor's way of being lighthearted or funny. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. We here at VOA Learning English hope you pass your next exam with flying colors. Or at least, we hope you don't bomb on your next project. I'm Ana Mateo.
Sometimes a visit to a national park means hiking rugged trails and climbing high mountains. Other times it means crawling through caves or rafting down a wild river. But this week we want to take it easier. So we head south to the state of Arkansas. It is home to a national park that is perfect for resting and renewing a tired body. Visitors treat themselves to one of its natural thermal baths. Humans have been enjoying the warm waters for thousands of years. Welcome to Hot Springs National Park.
Most national parks are far from cities and industry, but Hot Springs is different. It covers more than 2,200 hectares in and around the city of Hot Springs, Arkansas. Congress approved special protection of the area in 1832. Known unofficially as America's Spa, it became a national park in 1921. The park's geothermal springs and other resources have long been used for therapeutic bathing. The average temperature of the hot springs is 61 degrees Celsius. The thermal mineral waters reportedly help ease many health problems, including arthritis and rheumatism. The springs emerge along the western edge of Hot Springs Mountain. Scientists say the hot springs are made of rainwater that fell in the hot springs area thousands of years ago. The rainwater slowly dripped down to the Earth's crust. When water rises back up to the surface quickly and does not have a chance to cool, hot springs form.
Hot Springs National Park's early bathhouses were simple structures. They were made of canvas and lumber. They were built right over some of the natural springs. Later, businessmen built more complex wooden structures. But those structures were frequently damaged by fires and from exposure to water and steam. Beginning in the early 1900s, stone, stucco, and brick structures replaced the wooden bathhouse buildings. These large and much more elaborate structures still stand today along what is known as Bathhouse Row. These bathhouses were built along the eastern bank of Hot Springs Creek. The hot water from the hillside springs flows down a system of wooden troughs and into the buildings.
Each spring was said to help cure different kinds of conditions. Some of the early names referred to their chemical properties. Others were named after the part of the body that its waters could best help. There was once a spring called Kidney, and another named Liver. 8 buildings line Bathhouse Row today. They are very large. Many of them are 3 levels. But most of them no longer offer therapeutic water treatments. Instead, they house park shops and the visitor center. But one has remained open for more than 100 years. The Buckstaff Bathhouse has operated continuously since 1912. It is one of the best preserved bathhouses within Hot Springs National Park. Visitors today can enjoy traditional thermal mineral baths. The baths are different temperatures and have different properties.
Another bathhouse offers a more modern spa experience. Quapaw Baths and Spa also sits along Bathhouse Row. It was renovated and reopened in 2007 on Hot Springs' 175th anniversary. When you are done with your relaxing bath, there is still more to enjoy at Hot Springs National Park. Visitors can hike along the more than 43 kilometers of trails in the park. You will find unusual rock formations and views of the surrounding rolling hills. The landscape provides evidence of the area's hot spring history. On the Tufa Terrace Trail, you will see huge deposits of tufa created by the flowing springs over thousands of years. Tufa is a kind of rock shaped by water.
But you do not have to hike to see the sights. There are beautiful mountain roads to drive as well. However you explore Hot Springs National Park, you can't help but relax. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.